From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2013 when actress Angelina Jolie wrote an op-ed in the New York Times about her decision to have a double mastectomy. Jolie wrote that her mother struggled with cancer for almost a decade and died at the age of 56. Jolie herself carried a genetic mutation and was told by doctors that she had an 87% risk of developing breast cancer and a 50% risk of ovarian cancer. Jolie wrote, quote, "Once I knew that this was my reality, I decided to be proactive and to minimize the risk as much as I could. I made a decision to have a preventive double mastectomy. I started with the breasts as my risk of breast cancer is higher than my risk of ovarian cancer and the surgery is more complex," end quote. She says she shared her story with the hope that other women could benefit from her experience. And according to the National Center for Biotechnology Information, the so-called Angelina Jolie effect led to a significant increase in requests for genetic testing and risk reduction bilateral mastectomies among women without previous cancer diagnoses. Now, it's one example of how celebrities have influenced public opinion when it comes to preventing or treating breast cancer. It's also sparked questions about whether any of us are too quick to ask for preventive surgery unnecessarily, or if this kind of a trend, this kind of conversation is healthy for the wider culture. Well, Dr. Avis O'Connell has spoken about this subject. This hour, we'll talk about the impact on the wider culture, about knowing our breast health, especially when we see it become a subject for the tabloids. And really, this hour, it's a chance to go beyond that and say, if you have any questions about screening, risk factors, genetic testing, how to know when to start getting tested. I know it feels like, you know, maybe every few years you might hear something different, but this is a chance to hear from the experts about what we ought to be doing and when it comes to breast health. So let's welcome our guest for the hour. Dr. Avis O'Connell is with us, a professor of imaging sciences at the University of Rochester Medical Center and the section chief of breast imaging. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us is Dr. Michelle Shane, associate professor in hematology and oncology and director of the Hereditary Cancer Screening and Risk Reduction Program at the University of Rochester Medical Center. I stuck the landing in practice with that long title, Dr. Shane. Sorry I bungled it on the air. It's nice to have you.
Thank you so much.
And also with us is Pat Battaglia, Associate Program Director for the Breast Cancer Coalition of Rochester. Pat, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And Kim Provenzano is here. Kim is a nurse practitioner at the Rochester Regional Health's Lipson Cancer Institute. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
So, We all see the stories when it comes to the celebrity culture, and I'm just going to start with Dr. O'Connell here because this is something that gets people talking in a way that can be hard for the experts to get people thinking more about it. Sometimes, for some reason, Angelina Jolie gets us talking more than Avis O'Connell does. No offense to Avis O'Connell. Has this been a good thing?
I think it's a good thing, and I think the celebrity going public with their diagnosis and their issues always raises awareness, and we're all about raising awareness. So yes, Michelle will talk about Angelina Jolie and the risk. She had a very high risk. Most women listening in will have an average risk of about 1 in 8. Angelina Jolie was in a completely different category. So this brings us to the discussion, how do you know which category you're in? And there are some red flags that we can talk about. But when Angelina Jolie went public, people started asking questions, and that was a very good thing.
Are there other celebrity stories that have sort of also picked up public currency on this? And are there any downsides to this, Doctor?
I don't know of any downsides, really. I think the celebrity culture does just make the awareness. And we think if it can happen, we hear about people who on their first screening on air during cancer month are diagnosed and everybody says, oh, my goodness, you know, maybe I should get screened. I think it just brings it down that if the celebrities with all their money and all their connections and all their everythings can get breast cancer, then we can all take notice of that. I mean, you remember Elizabeth Edwards when she was touring with her husband. And when I asked her, she was one of our speakers in Rochester, and I asked her not too directly, but like, had she been getting her screening? And she said, you know, I kept putting it off because I had to go on a campaign trip. I kept canceling it and I kept waiting to rebook it. And then by the time she found the lump, she had skipped several years. She admitted to 3 years. So that message, which she spoke in Rochester, she gave us that message. So when any celebrity goes public and tells from their heart what happened to them, people will listen. And I think they get bored at us radiologists telling them, get your mammogram. But when it comes down to somebody who had, I mean, how about Sandra Lee, when Andrew Cuomo's girlfriend came public of the fact that she had cancer, and you heard what she went through. She didn't tell us everything, but you got the idea that, and that's when he went public and started his No Excuses campaign and changed changed some of the New York State laws for insurance cover. So remember, he got on his motorbike and he went, stop me if I'm going on, but he went on his motorbike tour and it was called No Excuses, Get Screened. What he did was, so we all know that everybody gets full insurance cover with no copay or deductible for one mammogram a year. What he did was, people often say, well, if you find something, then who pays for that? What he made happen was that if you had to do follow-up imaging, that had to be covered too for New York State, and all the trickle down from your screening. So he did a huge service to the women of New York for that, and he still is trying to help out. So, yeah.
So a couple of points there before we kind of go around the table here, because I want to make sure I understand a couple of things here. Number one, when the law says, essentially the law before it changed said, yeah, you could get a screening with no copay. But if you need follow-up, it may not be covered. Was that deterring people from going at all?
It was. Some people said, it's all very well to give me a free screening, but then what happens afterwards? So this was to help that. It's not 100% yet, but now let me just clarify. In this entire country, any woman over the age of 40 can have one free mammogram. That predates the Affordable Care Act, and it even postdates the Affordable Care Act. The USPS task force keeps coming out with recommendations, but the law has never changed. It's still every year starting at 40.
Starting at 40?
Yeah.
And
it's not every 2 years starting at 50. It's every year starting at 40. It hasn't been changed.
Well, I think it depends who you ask, who you consult. So the American Cancer Society says that from 40 to 44, it's up to the individual woman. That's why I always encourage good conversations with between women and their primary care physicians who take a good family history as well. And then from 45 through 55 to go with an annual approach, and then from 55 to 74 to consider going on every 2 years on the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. Says, you know, they're more in line with starting at age 50, but they're very open to the concept of and the freedom that women may choose to act on ages 40 through 49, that they, again, may follow their own hearts regarding whether or not they want to undergo mammography at a younger age.
So when it comes to 55 to 74, forgive the ignorance, but I'm filled with ignorance. Why not every year? Why would every other year be okay?
We used to do every year, but the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, after a good bit of research on this, demonstrated that appeared to be appropriate for most women, again, of average risk.
Is that generally agreed here?
No.
Yes?
No. Well, the thing is...
No.
No.
Okay.
No, we know. We all just the thing is, we're the imagers who see the ladies who go 2 years, and so somebody at 54 has a mammogram, and it's negative. And 2 years later, at 56, they have a mammogram and they have a cancer there. And we know we would have seen it the previous year, and it would have been smaller. Now they may do just fine, but the point being that every year is good. You don't know if you only knew that you're going to be okay. So if you're of average risk and you don't know if you're going to get breast cancer at any age, you can come every year. I was just saying that it will be covered to come every year.
But do you advise coming every year?
I advise every year because I'm the person who sees the cancers on the person who didn't come every year.
Okay.
So the person age 45 who gets their first mammogram and they have a cancer, and you know if they waited to 50, that would have been a lot bigger. So if I hadn't got my perspective of sitting there and seeing the cancers that somebody never had a mammogram or skipped a few years. So I'm just seeing a different perspective. What we're saying is it's a choice for women, and that's the important thing. You can choose not to come, but if you come, it is covered once a year.
Is there any agreement, disagreement on the every year versus every other?
Well, we at the Breast Cancer Coalition are sort of the neutral voice in this argument. We advocate for the women and the men involved in this and encourage them to seek the input of their care providers, whether that's their primary care doctors, their gynecologist, whoever does their care for them, have these discussions, talk about their risk factors, because many people don't know what their risk factors are or what the risk factors are in general. And to read these reports from the United States Task Force and from the American Cancer Society and these different agencies that issue these reports, to measure that against their own values and their own approach to healthcare and make the decision that works for them.
Okay.
I think that's what speaks to why we're all here and why we're so passionate about the subject, is that it is about risk assessment. So it is about having that trust with your providers and that relationship to actually do an accurate risk assessment. So when we speak about Angelina Jolie going on a global level and, you know, advocating that everyone be tested with genetics, that may not be the answer. There may be some celebrity overtesting. In fact, I think we saw an uptick in genetic testing, but not an actual uptick in mastectomy services. So were women being tested that were appropriate? So the risk assessment is important, as is the interpretation of the test results and the management recommendations that are given by providers.
But Kim, this comes up every time we have this conversation, so I'll ask it before a listener does. They may ask you, well, what's the harm if I get tested when I don't really need it? Is there a possible harm
in having genetic testing?
In having any kind of testing, screening, et cetera, if you're not in a category of population that says you ought to be doing it or needing it.
Well, I mean, it's a personal decision for patients. There can be harm in over-testing, certainly. There's risk of false positives.
False negatives.
Anxiety.
Are the big risk, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You want to elaborate on that?
Sure. A false negative result means that you've had your test, you've had your mammogram, it's clear, it appears clear, and you think you're okay. And then 2 or 3 months later, you may present with a lump or a thickening or any one of the symptoms that can indicate that there's a problem. And don't be lulled into a false sense of security by a negative result when you see symptoms, to know your own body and to follow up on anything, regardless of when you've had your mammogram.
Well, this is where, again, I realize this is going to be a really ignorant question, but I think it's been one that's on my mind, and I suspect it's been on listeners' mind. When we think about every year versus every other, for in a population of women, say, 55 to 74 or post 50 or whatever the age threshold, I'm thinking of a family member who was diagnosed about a year and a half ago with Merkel cell carcinoma, and it's a real problem. It is not, do not be lulled into thinking this carcinoma is better than melanoma. This is significantly more dangerous and moves pretty quickly. And everything I try to read is to help inform me on how fast it may spread and what it may do. I don't know, here's the ignorance, I don't know if breast cancer has any typical progression rate. So, for instance, if I get a screening and it is a negative, and that's not a false negative, it's a negative, but in the next 2 years I'm going to get cancer and it starts the next day, does it take 2 years to grow to a certain point? Can be different speeds fed by different things? So forgive the ignorance, but I'm wondering if there's an average or a normal here.
It's not a single disease. It's a multifaceted disease. There are many different factors that can figure into the growth of it, so it's very individual, and you really don't know until you've got those biopsy results what you're faced with. So, yeah, it's important, again, to follow up with your care providers, get that biopsy,
okay,
and understand where you stand.
Okay. Dr. Shane, Dr. O'Connell, can you add to that in terms of the growth of tumors and how
fast? There's significantly high variability. Some cancers can grow extremely rapidly, and others have a more indolent pace and grow very, very slowly. In general, as we age, if we develop a cancer, a breast cancer, this is very, very general terms, the cancers tend to be slower growing in older age, as opposed to our younger patients in their 20s and 30s. The cancers can be extremely aggressive, but we have seen, you know, very aggressive cancers in older patients as well. So it's just everyone's different.
Is there typically, though, a set of circumstances in which you can predict that a tumor would grow more quickly?
No, not before it's diagnosed.
Other factors, no?
Not at this point, no.
Okay. Go ahead, Dr.
Let me add one thing. You started off by saying I had my mammogram and it was completely negative. That's a kind of a misconception.
Okay.
It means that we saw nothing. But this brings us to breast density. If your report comes out that you have extremely dense breasts and the mammogram is negative, it just means we didn't see anything. Unfortunately, it doesn't mean there couldn't be something subtle in there. Now, if you wait 2 years, that subtle thing might have become quite obvious. If you wait 1 year, we might pick up the changes. Unfortunately, it's not an exact science. A negative mammogram, because of lack of sensitivity, if we don't go into all the details, but if you have a very dense mammogram, there can be cancers hiding, and the best we can do is say we don't see it.
And even in the absence of high density, there are breast cancer subtypes like the so-called lobular carcinoma, which tends to be very difficult to identify on mammogram and even on physical exam for that matter. And it's not for lack of trying or lack of excellence on the part of our mammographers. They're doing the best they can, but this type of cancer really can evade mammographic detection.
Okay. Did you want to add to that, Pat?
We see a number of women, and we have a survivor community that we foster at the Breast Cancer Coalition. So we hear all kinds of stories, and just want to emphasize that every single story is different. We hear women who've come in and it was detected on their very first mammogram. We hear women who've come in and have gone for mammograms for years, and then weeks after a clean mammogram have found a lump that turned out to be carcinoma.
Yeah, and in some cases a very large cancer. And again, it's not anyone's fault that it was missed or anything. Some of these cancers are just very, very hard to see. People can be coming every year, as you said, and it goes undetected.
Well, I read out the outset here from that op-ed that Angelina Jolie wrote. She wrote that doctors told her she had an 87% risk. And I think Avis put the number on the average population at 12.5%.
12%.
One
in eight. Yeah, but that's where the risk-based screening. So if you looked at Angelina's family history, you would see that she had a mother history, and I'm sure there were other family members, which would have put her so high risk, so therefore the genetic testing would have been indicated. Everybody, so the family history plays into it, and that's where the genetic risk assessment comes in. There are two downsides to the getting the test. First of all, if you don't qualify for the test, according to the insurance companies, they won't pay, and they're not cheap. So you can't just walk in and say, I'll have a genetic test, please. The other thing is, if the genetic test comes back negative, it's negative for what they tested for, and they can't test for all the genetic, they're not testing for every genetic possibility that could be there. They can test for BRCA, that's the Angelina one. They can test and tell you you don't have BRCA 1 or 2. They don't tell you you don't have P10 or CHEK2 and all the other ones that can be tested for separately. So you need a proper risk assessment to even start ordering a genetic test.
Okay, so let's talk then, and I think Michelle, Kim can really help us understand who ought to be getting genetic tests. And so give me a scenario, maybe a set of factors that help us say, yes, you should be getting a test. Here's your family history or whatever the case may be. How do we know?
So we know through the outreach with this that any woman who is diagnosed with breast cancer young, under age 45, should be recommended genetic testing. Women with strong family history, so women who have family members on either side of the family, mom or dad side, that have relatives.
Just one or multiple?
They can have just one and actually be at risk. And so I think some of the debate about, you know, recommending genetic testing with the task force recommendations that every woman should be recommended genetic testing. That's one of the latest guideline updates that all women with breast cancer should be recommended genetic testing. I don't know that I necessarily agree with that, but it definitely warrants a good family history. So there are certain red flags. Male breast cancer in a family is a red flag. Ovarian cancer in a family is a red flag for genetics. So those are some of the very high risk features.
So thank you for indulging again my ignorance, and I'm going to try not to embarrass myself with this question, but I can't be the only one wondering. When you say any person who's had breast cancer is now being by the task force told.
The task force.
But, okay, and again, I apologize for this, but if the idea of genetic testing is to help you determine if you could get cancer, if you've already had cancer, do you need the testing? What is the testing going to then further elucidate for you?
Well, the testing may show risk for other cancers. It may show risk for second primary breast cancers. It may show risk for ovarian cancer. And it also informs family members for what their screening should be. So that's probably one of the biggest upsides to the genetic testing, is that it can inform an entire side of the family.
What does the testing actually entail?
So the testing entails a comprehensive family history, a risk assessment, where we look at family history features, we look at ages at diagnosis, we look at patterns in families, and the test itself is actually very easy to do. It's either a blood or buccal swab, where a patient submits a sample and it's sent off to a laboratory where multiple genes are analyzed. I think Angelina's disclosure of her BRCA mutation was huge, but I actually think that the Supreme Court 2013 ruling that genetic testing cannot be patented was actually a huge awareness, because we were allowed to have multiple laboratories provide testing for patients. So I think that even beyond her announcement was that announcement that BRCA testing cannot be patented, that more than one laboratory can offer testing.
I wanted to add another benefit for genetic testing in patients with breast cancer, in particular patients with metastatic breast cancer. We now use genetic testing to help determine whether or not a particular form of treatment is available to patients, that it would be an effective form of treatment, the so-called PARP inhibitors. And they may help to really control the metastatic disease, the stage four or often incurable types of breast cancer. So we are now using breast cancer to inform decision making with respect to treatment.
If I remember correctly, earlier in the hour, for those asking about insurance, genetic testing is only covered under certain circumstances by insurance. Is that correct?
For if patients meet particular criteria.
Not for everybody.
Not for everybody, okay, but that's what I was alluding to with the Supreme Court ruling against the monopoly on laboratory testing, is that now there are more affordable services available. So patients can actually have this testing not for $4,000, which was the standard cost for this testing if they didn't meet insurance criteria, but they can get this testing for under $300. Same exact testing. So we've really opened up a huge area of access for people to get testing, even if they don't meet insurance criteria.
Are more people getting testing as a result
Absolutely.
Of that?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What kind of change have you seen there? I mean, is it quantifiable how many more are getting testing?
I mean, almost every patient I see that is appropriate for testing that wants the testing can now get it because they have affordable access to it.
Wow. Listeners, if you want to join the program. We're talking about screening, understanding breast health, and the best recommendations from the experts here. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email connections@WXXI.org. Can I just briefly ask the panel, because Kim, you weighed in and said you're not quite sure you're there with the task force on any person who's had breast cancer should get a genetic test. Mm-hmm. You don't necessarily agree with that yet?
I don't. I actually think it needs to be a personal conversation with the patient and their providers. I think that a risk assessment needs to be done. I don't think that we should blanket statement every patient needs genetic testing. I don't see the value or importance of doing that.
Okay. Any disagreement there, Pat?
No, I tend to agree with that, because the information that you have that you obtain through genetic testing impacts you, it impacts your family, and you need to understand the impact that it's going to have on everybody before you go ahead and make that decision whether or not that it is right for you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Dr. Shane, agree?
I agree. I think we need to look at the individual, the family history in detail, if it's available. If someone doesn't know their family history, if someone's adopted or for whatever reason doesn't know one side of the family or the other, then I think it makes sense after diagnosis of breast cancer to consider genetic testing. And this is something we were doing even before the Preventive Services Task Force made that recommendation.
Okay. Dr. O'Connell, where are you on that?
Yeah, at the tumor board at Wilmot, we tend to recommend under 50 to have the discussion, but it's always to have the discussion. It's never, mm-hmm. you must do it. This is the era of patient sort of awareness and decision-making for themselves.
That's sure, and this is where you can speak with a genetic counselor and make an informed decision about whether or not you want to go ahead with the testing.
Is it a case where if for Jolie it was 87% because of various risk factors, but for someone without these risk factors it's 12%? Is it a case where if you check certain boxes it starts to move up and it's going to end up some people maybe 40%, some maybe 60%?
Jolie had a specific deleterious gene mutation that does confer that lifetime, or upwards, I should say, of that lifetime risk, as it's been studied, this mutation in families. And you can find variations on these numbers when you look at individual families. That's how we like to tailor recommendations. We'll take standard national guideline recommendations and tailor them to an individual based on the individual's family history as well as they may know it. So 87% is just the upper limit of most of what you read about the BRCA2 mutation and the lifetime risk. Important to know that that risk is spread out over time. It's not the, you know, snapshot when you're meeting the patient, your risk is 87% today. You know, it's over, spread out over the lifetime. As is true with all of us, as we age, our risk for cancer in general increases.
So I was going to ask if there is a threshold at which the expert community recommends something like double mastectomy. My guess is hearing from the experts already this hour, there's so much individual approach, counseling, talking that there isn't a one-size-fits-all that you're not going to tell, well, you're at 60%, so now we say double mastectomy every time. But generally speaking, I know it can be tough when patients say, well, what would you do? But is there a threshold where you think, if I'm at this point, I'm going in that direction?
It's a fair question. I don't personally maintain a threshold because I think, again, everyone is different. And I never tell people you have to have a mastectomy, even if their lifetime risk is approaching 90%. But what I do is I lay out these figures and compare them to average risk figures, and then women themselves react to that. It's such a personal decision whether or not to undergo prophylactic mastectomy. For some women, it makes sense. For some women, it makes sense later in their lives. You know, it can have such an impact on decisions regarding, you know, if you still haven't had children yet and you want to breastfeed those children, and if you have mastectomy, you won't be able to do that. You know, so we have to have a lot of discussions about that. It can impact, a woman's sex life. For some women, they have to realize that if they have mastectomies, that the sensation of the skin is altered after the surgeon's scalpel does what it has to do. And so women need to understand these things. And so we have these very, very deep discussions about this to help women decide if it's right for them. But if they decide not to have risk-reducing surgery, or if they decide they want to but not quite yet, then we make it very clear that women should be undergoing annual, every year, mammogram as well as annual MRI of the breast in any high-risk situation, so long as the lifetime risk of developing breast cancer is in excess of 20%.
Okay. Dr. O'Connell?
Yeah, 20% is the number. So on the calculations that we do, the kind of rough calculations based on history, when we get to that 20% number, we recommend an additional screening MRI on top of an annual mammogram. Some people do them every 6 months. Some people do them both the same month. But that is the recommendation, over 20%. When you get up to the 80s, it's usually a timing issue. A lot of women will say, yes, I'll have a mastectomy. I do plan to have bilateral mastectomies, but I'm going to have a baby first or two. And that's fine too, but then they have to have surveillance in the years prior to that. And we do have lots of people doing that. But then culturally, there are some women who will absolutely refuse to have a mastectomy no matter what. They feel it makes them no longer a woman. And we have to respect that, and then they have the continuing screening. So for them, it's important to have the screening. But it's totally, nobody will, the days of a doctor telling you, you have to do this, hopefully are over. The woman makes, bring their family, bring anybody they want to have that discussion. And ultimately, it's their decision.
Okay, and I think it's also important to point out that I have no idea what that 87% goes down to after a double mastectomy. I assume it's not zero.
No, it's never zero. Yeah. It's actually called a risk-reducing mastectomy. We used to call it a prophylactic mastectomy. So it reduces it to very little because there's just a little rim of tissue left. There's almost no breast tissue. It's down to, what, less than 5%, would you say? It's
yes,
not zero.
But we are... always quick to point out that even after mastectomy, it is still possible to develop a cancer of the breast. And so women need to continue to pay attention to their bodies. If they ever feel, you know, a small lump or irregularity in the tissue that's new, that they should bring it to a doctor's attention as soon as possible.
Okay. Sarah says, I'm 36 years old, no risk factors that I know of. I missed the earlier part of your discussion. Do I need to start screening at 40?
The radiologist says yes, you start at 40, because if we find a little something at 40 and it's small and curable, you know, your lifetime risk of dying of breast cancer is reduced significantly. You don't know from the outside, and you don't, and the average risk person can still get breast cancer in their 40s. It's less common, but there are still significant numbers of people who get breast cancer in their 40s. So we recommend starting at age 40.
And I would say, let's see more about your family history. Maybe you should start already if you come from any sort of high risk background.
She just said, though, she didn't have one.
Yeah. Oh, okay, so okay. That's average
yeah.
risk.
Yeah.
And
average
she
risk.
Knows, and she must know her family,
if
too.
She knows.
Because sometimes people don't, they're not aware of cancer in the family. Years ago, it was something that wasn't discussed.
Exactly.
It was very hush-hush.
It was not discussed.
Women may know their family medical history to some extent with respect to heart disease and so on, but cancer may not have been discussed. Mm-hmm. So sometimes, and it's the another thing is that when we're younger, sometimes the older people in our families choose to keep this information from us. And so as we grow, we might want to inquire again mm-hmm. of relatives, is there any cancer in the family? So.
Well, it was considered a stigma. Cancer
yeah.
was not spoken of
right.
until Betty Ford and Happy Rockefeller mm-hmm. went public, what, in
yeah.
the 80s?
Mm-hmm.
It became okay to start talking about the fact, so dying of a dwindling disease and everybody hush hush, nobody knows exactly what it was. Nowadays people will come right out and say what the person has. Now, I'm not dying of it necessarily, but people are now willing to talk about the fact that mom or grandma had breast cancer.
Right.
The stigma is less. I won't say it's completely gone.
And you know, and the other thing that's important to point out is the entire family history, dad's side of the family does matter. Many times we only think about mom's side because in most cases, breast cancer is seen in women, but men can have breast cancer too, and there are other cancers that are associated with gene mutations that may still confer an increased risk of breast cancer, even though it's not seen so much in that particular family. So family history in general is very, very important.
I'm going to try to squeeze in as many of my and listener questions as we can get in before the end of the hour. You're hearing Dr. Michelle Shane, Associate Professor in Hematology and Oncology and Director of the Hereditary Cancer Screening and Risk Reduction Program at the University of Rochester Medical Center, alongside Dr. Avis O'Connell, Professor of Imaging Sciences at the University of Rochester Medical Center and Section Chief of Breast Imaging. Pat Battaglia is here, Associate Program Director for the Breast Cancer Coalition of Rochester. Kim Provenzano, a nurse practitioner at the Rochester Regional Health's Lipson Cancer Institute. If you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK as we talk breast health, imaging, genetic history, screening, and more. 844-295-8255. You can email connections@wxxi.org. Your feedback next. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on the Next Connections, Senator Elizabeth Warren says her pregnancy ended her teaching career in the 1970s. We talk about how the laws have changed, but how many women still feel pressure when it comes to their career and dealing with pregnancy and starting families. Then in our second hour, what would happen if political candidates put kids at risk first with all of their priorities? The children's agenda tells us. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Just now, one of our listeners on Twitter directed us to a story 5 years old now from the New York Times, February of 2014. And I'm sure all of our guests were aware of it because the headline alone probably causes some reaction throughout their work. And the headline was, "Vast Study Casts Doubt on the Value of Mammograms." And Avis is already sort of wincing and nodding. You know, it was a story that the New York Times reported about a study published in the British Medical Journal attempting to be a rigorous evaluation of mammograms in the modern era and determining that death rates from breast cancer and from all causes were the same in women who got mammograms and those who did not. Dr. O'Connell, that's a five-year-old study. I know it's been talked about, but people are still sharing this story. Was it valuable? Do you think it was misreported? What's the message now?
The difficulty is that all these headlines that say don't get your mammogram will end up with some women say, I mean, it's like anything else. If somebody says you don't need your colonoscopy for another 10 years, you'll say, great, I didn't want to do it anyway. People clutch at an excuse not to have a mammogram. I have to say that the death rate from breast cancer has gone down up to 40% since regular screening mammography happened. Now, if women aren't ever going to get breast cancer, then the screening mammogram didn't help them. But we know that breast cancer rates have gone down in the last 20, 30 years, and they had been stable before that. So we do also know the treatment has got better. But nobody would consider that treating a large cancer will be as successful as treating a small cancer. So we all cringed when that came out because it meant that a lot of people would decide not to have screening mammograms. We have to say that we feel that mammography does save lives and that the earlier, there's only two ways to find breast cancer if you're unlucky enough to get it. One is we find it before you feel it, and the other is you feel it yourself or your doctor. And we feel that the smaller that you can't feel will have a better outcome with the better treatment. So we did not like that study. And when you analyze these studies, you know how statistics are. You can pick the studies that tell your story. And it's very hard to mix all the studies. Some of them were badly done. Some were better done. Some were done every 2 years. Some did one view only. Some of them included women who had lumps in them, in the mammogram arm. And they said, hey, those ladies died more than the people who were screened. They were contaminated studies. So, you know, studies are great, but you have to drill down into the study to say, is this really an accurate reflection of what today's mammography is doing? Remember, in Britain, they screen every 3 years, not every 2 years, not even every 1 year. So you have to consider the source.
The person who shared it on Twitter is saying routine mammograms don't save lives. I know. Well, you disagree.
I do. I disagree. I think routine mammograms do save lives. Yeah.
I appreciate it. We're trying to sort through the data, but I'm also trying to listen to the experts. And I know that.
But it's an individual. If somebody doesn't want to have a mammogram, they don't need to have a mammogram. Yeah, yeah. But they should know that they have a risk regardless. And 1 in 8 people means that more people. Here's the thing. Most women are not going to get breast cancer. So they can go ahead and not get a mammogram and they'll be just fine. The thing is, from the outside, and Pat was going to tell us, right, that the risks to the average woman are not visible.
No, and about, I think it's 85% of breast cancers that are detected have no known risk factors involved, no family history, no genetic factors.
So the only way to find it would be the screening or wait
or
till you feel it.
Self-detection, yeah.
So that is the number. It's 75-85%, which means that the great majority of women. So I like to tell people your biggest risk factor is being female, and the second biggest is getting older, because the average age, the median age for detection is 62-61. So, you know, those are the numbers out there. You can take a chance and not get a mammogram and you may be fine, or you can wait till you find it yourself and, you know, you might be lucky. But most women would prefer to find it before they feel it.
Okay, so let me get back to your feedback here. Phil writes to us to say, good to hear information regarding different categories and risks. I know a woman who was 50-50 and chose a double mastectomy. I thought it a bit excessive. I know Phil means well, but is the notion of telling a woman's choice, especially if she's got a 50% risk, that it's excessive, is that potentially harmful or maybe something we should avoid?
Oh, absolutely. This is her decision and her choice and the level of risk that she chooses to live with. And that's the decision that she gets to make. And it's an informed decision based on conversations with her healthcare providers. She obviously has done this so that she can go through with her surgery and the follow-up and everything that's involved. So,
but remember that
we can never second guess.
A huge symptom is anxiety. If a person wakes up, if somebody has told you've got a 50-50 risk factor and you're thinking about it every day you wake up and you wonder, every twinge you get, you think this is breast cancer. If that person has that anxiety reduced by a very legitimate procedure, which a lot of other women would do, that is totally her decision. Because cancer concern or cancer worry is a huge burden for some people. The statistics may be 50-50, but if her mind is more worried than the average, then it's her call.
And someone else in the same position with the same odds would choose differently, and that's also a legitimate decision.
Like I said, I know you mean well, Phil, but I think the doctors are just trying to help us see that you got to support people with the choices they make once they are informed. And the wonderful part of what we're learning today is because of the medical system we have and the experts we have, people are going to make decisions after they've been informed. They're not all going to choose the same things. And you could probably find headlines post Angelina Jolie prognosticating that some people would, quote, have preventive surgery unnecessarily. What I'm learning this hour is I'm not sure there is a category of unnecessary preventive surgery or double mastectomy or whatever the case may be if it comes after informed consent. If someone's told you only have a 12% chance and that's still keeping you up and you make that decision, I don't know that I could tell that person that's not necessary, or is that wrong?
Well, sometimes the insurance company will tell you for you. The insurance company will not, if a person with a 12% risk walks up to a surgeon and says, I want a double mastectomy, they probably will not get insurance coverage. So, you know, you don't want the insurance company practicing medicine, but they do have some guidelines.
Okay.
And, you know, you have, you know, unless you want to pay it for yourself and get a surgeon to do it for you, you know. But generally, there are certain categories that your insurance will not cover.
Okay, that's fair enough. That's a different distinction, though. And I understand that insurance companies have to make those distinctions or at least draw some lines about what's going to get covered and what's not going to get covered. Then, you know, a lot of talk in recent years, especially since Jolie, about BRCA. And I wanted to ask a little bit about mental health services that might be available to women who've received screening and been told that they have the mutation in the BRCA1 gene. There's a lot of stress and fear that goes into those situations. So what's the support like? What's the approach like for patients who are going to have some decisions to make or a lot to consider? What's available?
Well, we at the Coalition have a number of support programs. I oversee our peer mentoring program. It's a PALS, P-A-L-S. It stands for Peer Advocates Lending Support. And we match people one-to-one. And we have done these matches with people who we term previvors. These are the people who've tested positive for a genetic mutation and are making decisions about risk-reducing surgery and want to talk to people who are living with this. And that's an important piece of the puzzle for them to consider, in addition to talking with their healthcare providers, to find a human contact with somebody who's actually living with the choices that they're considering.
Okay. I know we've had some questions about BRCA over the years. Are patients asking more about that? Does that come up more often? You know, just is there a lot of stress about that?
Well, no, when people hear about it, they want to be tested. But a big misconception is they say, oh, I was tested, I'm negative. And you feel like you were tested for which one and you're negative. And then if they get a lump, they say, well, I was tested and I'm negative. So there's a huge informational gap there, too, that when people say, oh, I got the genetic test and it was negative. So it was negative for BRCA, perhaps. So there's questions out there. And certainly every time a celebrity comes forward with something, everybody asks the question. They require a good answer and then the decision follows.
Yeah, that's a good point, Avis. I think we have to ask people when they had their genetic testing. And if all, say a woman had breast cancer and she had BRCA testing many years ago, we might consider expanding to other genes that are associated with breast cancers and other types of cancers. And that's why it's a good idea to revisit these discussions with patients. The other thing that happens over time is that patients' family medical stories change over time. Other family members develop cancers, and this can help guide us, those of us who counsel individuals regarding genetic testing. The risk profile changes with time. So it's a bit of a moving target, but I think it behooves us to continue to have ongoing conversations with our patients.
Let me just try to keep squeezing as much as we can here. We've had some people asking about direct-to-consumer genetic testing like that offered by 23andMe, Ancestry DNA. Good Kim, question. You want to hit that? What do you make of those?
So it's complex. Direct-to-consumer testing is not medical-grade testing, and that should, you know, hopefully be very clear. I see a lot of patients who come in with their direct-to-consumer testing, and it's false. It needs to be repeated. The results are not accurate. So we need to be very careful about deciphering the information.
So first of all, it's not scientifically perfectly sound here.
The interpretation of the results can vary. So the testing is very good at looking at ethnic backgrounds and regions of where we may have come from. But as far as medical grade testing and clinical use of the results of that testing, it is not. It's not ready for prime time.
Do you warn people against using it?
I don't warn them against using it. I just need them to be informed about why they're using it and what they're using it for. And I encourage them to bring in their results to have discussions about, you know, what we can use in the clinical arena. But most often, if I get a patient that has a BRCA in one of the Jewish founder mutations on a 23andMe, I repeat the test. And upwards of 50% of the time, I get a discordant result.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for that. Crystal writes to say, I've heard that mammograms can cause cancer. Is this true?
No. Mammography has never been shown to cause any cancer. The reason why there's a question there is that radiation, high doses of radiation, like hundreds, even thousands of times what a mammogram is. A mammogram is like a few weeks of background radiation. But there are people who are survivors of lymphomas and other cancers that required high doses of radiation, typically Hodgkin's or Hodgkin's lymphoma with radiation to the chest in their 20s and 30s. Those women are at a definite higher risk, and we look at them very carefully 8 to 10 years after they finish their treatment. So radiation at extremely high doses can cause cancer, but radiation at the doses for a mammogram has never, ever shown caused a cancer.
All right, Crystal, hope that answers your question. Here's Julie, who writes to say, I'm a breast cancer survivor and a former patient of Dr. Shane. Hello. And I have two comments and a question. She says, first, thank you for emphasizing that genetic tests don't screen for every possible breast cancer-related gene. My paternal grandmother and paternal aunt both had breast cancer. My aunt was young at diagnosis, as was I, age 43. However, my genetic testing came up negative for the BRCA mutation. Two, please let your listeners know that the technology is constantly improving. Last year, 7 years after diagnosis and original testing, I was encouraged to be retested because more genes are now being looked at. Breast cancer genetic links still came up negative, but the test found an increased risk for colon cancer, which is also in my family. So a question, is there any push for insurance to cover regular screening via ultrasound? My cancer was not seen on a mammogram, but was caught while undergoing an ultrasound during the same appointment for what turned out to be a benign lump. Had I not had the ultrasound, another year would have gone by with a tumor growing. Ultrasound is non-invasive, does not expose anyone to x-rays, must be less expensive to purchase and maintain than a mammogram machine. Seems like a no-brainer to me, but insurance will not cover it unless there is a specific concern, like a lump, to be checked. That comes from Julie.
Well, we do offer supplemental screening with ultrasound on women with dense breasts, and the insurance is an issue. Right now, everybody, as I said earlier, can have a no-cost sharing mammogram, but there's no such thing at this time for a no-cost sharing ultrasound. We do encourage women, when they get the dense letter and it says your breasts are dense, your mammogram is negative, but you might want to consider supplemental screening. have the discussion with your doctor. Then they have to have an order placed and an indication given. Maybe dense breasts will pass and the insurance may cover with co-pays and deductibles, but it's not as simple. We would love to do ultrasound on every person who has dense breasts, but we have to be aware there's also a rule against doing an exam that can cause, there's a no surprise bill that went through Congress. So you cannot do an exam on a person who's not expecting a bill and then they'll get a bill. So if you come in for your routine mammogram and you never get a bill for that, and then we decide to do a screening ultrasound because the insurance says there's no such thing, you do a screening ultrasound, then they will get a bill and it could be several hundred. And so the rules are you cannot do an exam. So you'd have to stop and say to them, are you aware what this might cost? Do you still want it? And then if they are aware and they still want it, we're happy to do it. We do pick up cancers on an ultrasound after a negative mammogram.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
I would love to thank Julie for bringing up that point, because actually BRCA isn't the entire picture with the risk factors and the genes. And we know that there's considerable overlap between genes and cancer risk. So the fact that a different gene with different cancers was identified in her family, that may actually help her advocate to get better screening for breast cancer, because what we know about genes that cause colon cancer today, we may learn influence risk for breast cancer in the future. So that's a really important point.
Oh, I have a very good point. Anybody who's got political connections, if any politicians are listening, there are some states who, if you have a mandated letter that says from the radiologist your breast tissue is dense, there are some states, I know Connecticut was the first one, the insurance must cover a screening ultrasound. New York is not one of those. So let's get, this could be the day we start the campaign to get screening ultrasound covered in New York State.
And by the way, they all listen, all the politicians.
Excellent.
They all just
good.
Do. We know they listen. Thank you for the time and the expertise. The entire hour, all of our guests, you just heard Dr. Avis O'Connell. Thank you, Dr. O'Connell. Thank you for being here. Thanks to Dr. Michelle Shane. Thank you, Dr. Shane. Really great.
Thanks so much for having me.
You got it. Pat Pataglia from the Breast Cancer Coalition. Thank you, Pat.
Thank you.
And Kim Provenzano from Lipson Cancer Institute. Thank you, Kim.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Dolores Parlato, who is volunteering with us today. Emma Ray Stein is the intern. Megan Mack is the producer. Rob Braden is the engineer. And Barsook Records, a big thank you to them for the music from Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a beautiful weekend. We're back with you Monday on member-supported public radio.